Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Today we talk with Russell Gold, a Wall Street Journal reporter and author of The Boom. The book covers the history of hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, in the United States and the characters who made it what it is today. Gold spoke with WPSU's Emily Reddy about the evolving technology of fracking, which has included the use of everything from napalm to nuclear bombs. The controversy about assigning the boom to Penn State freshmen, and Gold's parents' story about leasing their land in Sullivan County, Pennsylvania.
So you start this book with the story of your own parents leasing their land in Sullivan County a few years ago, and how they were really conflicted over this choice. And you'd been reporting for the Wall Street Journal on oil and gas drilling in the U.S. since the mid-2000s, right. Just coincidentally, and they asked you for advice.
All right. It all came home, right? So this is land. They didn't live on the land. It's a little different than most people's experience in Pennsylvania, but they'd owned it since the early 70s. They felt very attached to it. And one day I get a phone call from my mother saying, you know, there's this company, Chesapeake. Have you ever heard of them? They want to lease our land. They want to do this fracking thing. What is that? And, you know, in some ways, I was the perfect person to ask, right? I had been working for the Wall Street Journal, reporting on fracking for about 5 years at that point, since 2003 on. But when she asked me it, you know, it really hit home because this was no longer a business story. This was now, what should we do? And it was a very small leap from being asked that in a family sense to sort of taking that question and saying, well, what should we be doing? You know, as a country, should we be embracing fracking or not? Which is really the jumping off point for the whole book. And that's really the central question that everything else kind of flows from.
And your parents did end up leasing their land.
Yeah. So my dad drove around and talked to all the neighbors. We're surrounded up there. This is about 100 acres. And this is the land that none of the farmers wanted because it's really rocky and really hilly. So it's we're surrounded by farms. There's used to be dairy farms, now mostly corn and other crops. And so he drove around and found out that all the neighbors already leased. So he knew we can't stop this from happening. We're going to get the trucks. We're going to get the rigs. You know, all this is going to be happening. And so my advice to them was, look, if you want to do this, it's going to mean a lot of money. Their timing was really good when they leased. They leased right more or less at the top of the market. And before you lease, once you lease, I say you lose control. It's over. They're going to do what they're allowed to do. So figure out what you want and write as good a contract as you can. You know, where do you want this drill pad to be? Tell them. And if they don't agree, don't sign the lease. But the other reason I gave them for signing the lease and for saying, you know, you should do it, is because I knew that natural gas was not a perfect fuel, but a better fuel than what we have. And it would, by sort of being part of that drilling of natural gas, production of natural gas, it was going to slowly phase out coal. And, you know, as an energy reporter, I was well aware of coal's contribution to climate change, but also just so many pollutants and irritants and things in coal production that are not good for the health. And I thought natural gas was better. So I did actually, in the end, advise them to go for it.
And I'm struck by, you talk with a number of farmers in these areas who, you know, they're used to working the land. Your parents were looking for a beautiful place to be.
Right.
These farmers are used to using it for crops, for raising dairy cows. And so they have this idea that the land is meant to be exploited in some way.
Sure.
And often it's the first time they have a chance at any kind of real money out of their land, too.
You know, it really is one of the eye-opening things that happened to me in reporting this book is that, I grew up in Philadelphia. I'm a city kid. And, you know, I'm sort of embarrassed to admit it, but I had this sense that people out in the country were kind of naive. And when I started really sitting and talking to them about the land and the decisions that they'd made, I realized that they were incredibly sophisticated about their land because that was the basis of their wealth. What you could plant on the land and pull from the land and how large a herd of cow you could have out there. I mean, that was all connected to the land. They were very smart and savvy about their land. And so, you know, they were making good choices based on, you know, the information they had.
But that doesn't mean that they were necessarily happy with how things
were
done.
No, very conflicted often. But, you know, you're bringing up the point that there is and there has been for a long time, a rural poverty issue in this state. And these were farmers who were hanging on, were not generating a lot of money, were frankly watching the economy pass them by as people in cities were getting richer and richer and enjoying a higher and higher standard of living. And what was going on in the farms in rural America was not happening in the same pace. And then when you have a company like Chesapeake and Landmen come in and say, we'll give you, $5,000, $10,000 an acre, this was life-changing kind of money. It was money to send the kids off to college. It was money to reinvest in the farm so that you can keep it going for another generation. So it was really hard to walk away from.
So there's the present of the book, but this book, on the whole, is really a history of natural gas development and the major players in that development over the past 150 years or so. And one of the things I was interested to find out that fracking actually has some of its oldest roots here in Pennsylvania, Titusville. In the 1860s.
Well, you know, that blew me away, too. I always thought, the original oil rush in western Pennsylvania in Titusville, they were just drilling wells and up would come the oil. And as it turns out, no, that the successful wells, that one of the absolutely essential tools back then was you drilled the well and then you put basically amounted to some nitroglycerin or a stick of dynamite at the bottom of the well on a little string and then would drop a fishing weight off the string that would then detonate it. And the whole purpose is that if you drilled this well, you could come within 6 inches of an oil seam. And it could be a duster, a bad well. But if you set off this explosive and you created some new fractures in the rock, one of those fractures might hit an oil seam. And it would be the difference between no money and lots of money. And the guy who was pioneering this, Colonel Roberts, was going around selling his torpedo, is what he called it. He ended up being one of the richest people in the United States because everyone needed to use his torpedo. It really was the difference. It was a make or break on a well. So this idea that you're going to fracture the well, they didn't call it fracking back then, but they did talk about fractures, goes back 150 years. It really is amazing.
And then we go to Burke Burnett, Texas in 1919, where...
Oh, that's Burke Burnett, ma'am.
Burke Burnett?
Burke Burnett.
Burke Burnett. Then you go to Burke Burnett, mm-hmm. Texas in 1919, where oil drilling creates a precedent that says subsurface rights are dominant over surface rights, which is a very important thing today.
No, absolutely. So what happened in Burke Burnett and many other boom towns in Texas is that someone would find some oil, and then before you knew it, there were just derricks everywhere. And in fact, I was just looking at some great old historical photos from places like Ranger and Burke Burnett, which you can't believe how thick these derricks are.
And if you think there aren't enough regulations now...
There was nothing. There was nothing. I mean, literally sometimes the oil would flow in the streets, and that was just what happened. If you worried about being overrun by workers from out of town, I mean, they were literally in some of these boom towns sleeping on porches because there was no place left to sleep. But there was this guy named Otis Grimes, and so he was actually an oil field worker. He moved there and bought a house with his family and his kids. And somebody put a derrick right up next door to his house, so close that he could not open his back door. The motor that ran it was basically right outside his house, and he couldn't talk inside his house. And so, Otis Grimes gets upset and takes the driller to court and basically says, no, you can't do this. And the driller says, no, well, we have the mineral rights. And, too bad. And it goes up, and Texas courts essentially say the driller's right. It is a precedent which existed back then, and the purpose of that precedent was that the state wanted the development of oil and gas and wasn't going to let a landowner get in the way. And that's going to sound very familiar to people today because that's what Act 13 was all about here in Pennsylvania. In Texas, we just had the city of Denton, a sort of a state colleges type town with universities up there, ban fracking. And what does the state do? Turns around and says, no, you can't do that. We're going to ban bans on fracking. So this whole tension between who gets to control, do the landowners get a say, or do those mineral rights trump? And the courts have consistently said mineral rights trump everything because we want to encourage that oil and gas development.
So moving on from 1919 Texas, the late 1940s, this was crazy to me. They used napalm to try. They tried using napalm for fracking.
Yeah, well, they used it successfully. You needed something that had low friction. And this was late 1940s. And I actually always associated napalm with the Vietnam War. But apparently the military used napalm in the Pacific Theater in World War II. We had all this leftover napalm. You know, the story of how modern fracking begins in Tulsa, Oklahoma is really fascinating because this is one of the first laboratories, really, where an oil and gas company will hire a whole bunch of scientists and say, look, your job isn't to go drill wells. Your job is to sort of figure out how to do this better. You sort of think of a Bell Laboratory kind of thing. And that's what they were doing in Tulsa. And they were working on this idea of how do we make cement better? Because cement is used in oil wells. And they wanted to make cement better. And they kept putting cement in this one well and losing it. And they kept thinking, where's the cement going? They finally realized, hey, the cement is so heavy, we're creating cracks. And somebody had this great idea. Well, maybe we could do this on purpose, and we could use the weight of the water pumping in to create fractures in the rock. And that's where the idea of using water hydraulic fracturing comes from. But even back then, if you think about you're pumping water down a well, there's a lot of friction involved. So you needed to somehow slicken it. Is what later became to be called slick water fracking. And that's where the napalm comes into it, because that worked as a slickening agent. And if you look at these old photos of some of the world's first frack jobs in places like the Hugoton Basin of Kansas, all the pieces of equipment are as far away from each other as they can because they were worried about it blowing up. And they figured if they, you know, a modern frack job, you know, all the trucks are squeezed together tightly. I'm sure people have seen pictures of this, but back then they're all spaced out across a cornfield in Kansas because they were afraid something was going to blow up, and they didn't, you know, if one thing blew up, okay, but we didn't want everything to blow up.
And then nuclear bombs in the 60s and 70s.
Well, sure, of course. I mean, when you're thinking of fracking, who doesn't think of nuclear bombs, right? You know, this comes out of this 1950s idea that we're starting to build nuclear bombs, and maybe we can find a peaceful purpose to use nuclear bombs. And so the Atomic Energy Agency goes off and does this. I think Edward Teller, the father of the bomb, is involved with this process. And they come up with all these great ideas. Maybe we can use bombs to build a new deep water port in Alaska was one of their ideas. And then one of the other ideas, and industry was involved in this, was, well, we're using water to fracture rocks. And that's going pretty well. But what can, you know, if you really want to create a fracture, why not just try a nuclear bomb? And, you know, it's sort of, this is the era when if you're out in Las Vegas, you can see the mushroom clouds off in the distance. I mean, you know, we were a lot less squeamish, I suppose, about nuclear explosions back then. And, you know, a couple of years ago, I drove out from Denver to where one of these sites were. It all happened in the West. And I found the well. And, you know, it's amazing because there's no sign. All there is a little plaque on the ground with a nuclear hazard symbol, and it says, do not dig, radioactive. So,
because, I mean, not surprisingly, there was too much radiation
that
in
was the whole problem.
The gas,
yes,
in the oil,
I mean,
and gas.
It, you actually could fracture the rock. You sort of ended up creating a big cavity, and there would be some gas, but when they studied it, they realized that the gas was radioactive. And if you were to put this radioactive gas into the pipeline system, you would have people nearby Rifle and Aspen turn on their stoves and get a radioactive dosage.
You are listening to Take Note on WPSU. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Wall Street Journal reporter Russell Gold about his new book, The Boom. It's this year's Penn State Reads book, which is assigned to all Penn State freshmen.
And then we have one of the main, you know, one of the big people in your story, George Mitchell,
right,
who's fracking in Texas starting in the 1950s. He's known as the man who set off the shale revolution. His son called him obsessed.
Yes, yes. Well, so George Mitchell is one of these sort of great made in America, only America stories, son of immigrants, puts himself through college at Texas A&M and goes out and gets 20,000 acres of lease north of Fort Worth. And it's an okay field. It's not great, but, you know, it's enough. You know, Mitchell Energy was a very successful company. He was not wanting, you know, he's a fairly wealthy man. But, you know, over the years, he starts developing this field in the 1950s, and by the 1980s, it's starting to really run down. And he's got a problem because he's got a contract, a pipeline contract to deliver gas to this pipeline. And he realizes, well, my source of gas is starting to run out. I've got to come up with another way. And he's well aware that every time he drills deeper, a deeper well, and they pass through this one strata of rock called the Barnett Shale, his instruments show gas, where there's some, they're detecting gas. And so he's, from 1982 on, comes up with this idea that we're going to figure out a way to fracture the shale. And the difference is, so they've been fracturing at this point for 30, 35 years, but they're fracturing sandstones. They're fracturing really porous type rocks. Shales are incredibly dense. I mean, there's almost nothing that's denser than they are. So how are you supposed to do that? And he basically tells his company, look, go out and do it. Keep trying to do it and see what you can come up with. And like 3, 4, 5 wells a year from 1982 onward, he does that. You know, and I should mention that a lot of the original work on fracturing shales was done in a Department of Energy experiments out of West Virginia, out of Morgantown. So they were experimenting with it. They had done some of the original work, and those studies end up in George Mitchell's hands. And he sort of sees them and says, you know what? This is really intriguing. I'm going to see if I can do this in Fort Worth. So late 1990s, after 15 years of failed experiments, a Mitchell employee finally sort of pieces together how to do a hydraulic fracturing in shale and makes the shale start giving up its gas. And June or July of 1998 is when you really have the world's first modern shale well, which is kind of amazing because, you know, sometimes I'm asked, well, how long are these shale wells going to produce? And I say, I don't know. We've got one that's been on production for, what is it now, 17, 18 years. You know, we don't have the data on it yet. But so he starts growing production. And at that point, Mitchell's old. His wife's in the early stages of Alzheimer's. He wants to, and none of his kids want to take over the company. He wants to get out. So he finds this buyer in Devon. And Devon realizes, that the Devon execs from Oklahoma City realize, look, if this can only be done with vertical wells, the old way, this is a good buy, but not a great buy. But if we can just figure out how to combine horizontal wells with this new fracking technique, they didn't even call it fracking back then, they just called it unconventional stimulation, this is really going to be a home run. And Devon does that. And you know, the production in the Barnett Shale goes through the roof. But then Devon makes it an enormous mistake in some ways. They say, and when I found this, I was dumbfounded, in one of their early 2000 filings with the SEC, they say the Barnett Shale is unique. This is the only place you can do something like this. There's nothing else like that. Well, that was not exactly right. They missed the Eagleford and the Haynesville Shale and the Fayetteville Shale, and then of course they missed the Marcellus Shale also and the Utica. So that idea that this was unique was the reason why you have other companies that just sort of took this idea that Devon had, bringing together horizontal drilling and fracturing, and just went to the races with it.
But I thought it was interesting. I mean, one of those other companies that really decides they're going to get into this, Chesapeake Energy, Aubrey McClendon, he really just hit it hard. He wanted to get out there, be the first,
right,
buy all the land, put in all the wells.
Well, you know, the best way to think about Aubrey McClendon was that he was something of a real estate speculator disguised as an oil and gas man. So, you know, he wanted to go out and lease up land before anyone else. And you talk to his competitors at the time, and they say, you know, we thought we were spending fairly aggressively going out and leasing land, and in comes Chesapeake, and they triple our budget, and, you know, what we have to compete with them. So he's grabbing land everywhere. I mean, he wants to have the number one or number two position in all of these different shales across the country. And he does that. And then, much like a real estate speculator, he starts selling off pieces of it, to international companies and making some money off that. But, you know, look, at the end of the day, Aubrey McClendon, you know, he wanted to create this giant company, and he did. Just the problem was it was a little too big. And when it grew a little too fast and when the price of gas started going down, he just couldn't financially keep it going.
I mean, he was doing some pretty questionable financial deals to keep being able to buy.
He was, you know, look, it was interesting that fracking was created by petroleum engineers. Aubrey McClendon was a financial engineer. He figured out as many different ways as he could to finance his dreams. And there was some questionable, nothing fraudulent, nothing illegal, but just figuring out every way he could to get money to finance his dreams to create a giant oil and gas company. And that's what he did.
And he was finally pushed out of Chesapeake in 2013.
Yeah, it caught up to him because it wasn't enough for him to be the CEO of a giant company. He also took these tiny little stakes in every well Chesapeake drilled. Personal, I think it was 2.5% stakes. And so not just is he running or trying to run this big company, he's also at night or whenever he was doing it, trying to finance this operation because he needed to pay for all of this. And finally, he borrows money from a company that he's selling to as Chesapeake. And when the news of this comes out, the board of directors of Chesapeake, which was a pretty compliant bunch, I must be said, this is too much.
I mean, as you're covering this, as you're seeing this one of these characters in real time, did you always think as you were covering this industry, there's a book in this?
Well,
I'm going to write this book.
Yes, by that time, actually, I was actively working on the book. But there's no question. I mean, as I was watching the rise of Aubrey McClendon, the spread of shale, I started thinking to myself, there is definitely a book in this. Because what I felt like I was watching was just a change in the country. And, you know, I had a front row seat to it.
You eventually, I mean, a lot of this starts out in Texas, but we get to Pennsylvania, aside from your parents' story. Mm-hmm. Fracking gets here about 2004 with Range Resources doing a lot of that early fracking. And they find out that the equipment they need to do this does not exist in Pennsylvania.
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. Because the last time Pennsylvania really was cutting edge in the oil industry, it was probably about 1900 or so. Right before kind of everything moved to Texas with the discovery of the giant Texas oil fields. So the Range Resources up there, and they're in stealth mode. You know, they don't want to be make a big deal, and they want to test some wells to see if what their geologists think is going to happen. It happens. And, you know, they're just dealing with these literally pieces of equipment from the 1940s. There's one great story where, you know, they're trying to work with local crews, but the local crews just have never drilled wells with this kind of depth or pressure before. It's like the local crews were driving Model Ts or something, and then they're being asked to step into, you know, a Formula One car. And so they pick up the phone to call this one consultant, basically say, we need you tomorrow in Pittsburgh, this guy down in Fort Worth. And so he's thinking to himself, okay, Pittsburgh, Texas, it's out in East Texas, a couple hour drive away. And they're like, no, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And it's just mind-boggling because you can't figure out what people are doing in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Well, another story you tell, and I mean, I remember this. It's about 2 hours west of here. In 2010, in Clearfield County, there was a well that the crew lost control of. It was spewing. It spewed 35,000 gallons of fracking fluid and brine into the air. And I was really interested in the inspection that they did on that. The company that did the drilling really looked into what happened. They did an in-depth investigation.
Oh, right. Yes,
into
yes.
What happened, and cement. I mean, the cement that lines the wells appeared to be the problem.
Yeah, and it failed. Yeah. Yeah. And this was what was fascinating about this, and I give lots of credit to this company, was that, you know, instead of just walking away and paying a fine, they genuinely wanted to know what went wrong. And they spent a considerable amount of money asking that question. So I give them a lot of credit for that. But, you know, they do this massive amount of work. They're putting every different kind of tool that they can find down the hole to sort of see. And, yeah, the answer is that the cement that's used to line the wells, because you sort of think a well is basically a steel pipe, and then you're going to cement around the outside just to kind of secure everything. Man was full of holes. It was spongy, basically. And that was a real problem because it allowed gas to escape up the outside of the well and to run up this open area. Because when you drill the well, there's more room than just to put the pipe down. So it's that is a big concern. And one of the things I write about is just how important it is to build the wells right. Because otherwise, you're going to have gas leaking all over the place. And let me tell you, gas will flow up and into the most accessible area. And the problem is that accessible area on the way up generally is drinking water aquifers. And that's why you have a genuine and real concern about methane charging up into aquifers.
You talk earlier in the book about at the turn of the century, that people were worried about properly casing the wells, but it was because they didn't want the water to get into the oil.
Into the oil, right, because they were pumping out too much water, you know. Yeah, and now we have this opposite situation. We are trying to protect the water. Yeah, Things change in this industry. They change slowly, but they do change.
I feel like the main push of the book is to talk about this history. Mm-hmm. And you talk a little bit about some of the downsides, the fact that methane can release into the atmosphere, that you're left with this water that has the chemicals in it. There was actually a petition that said, you know, we think this is too pro-fracking. It said, while other academic institutions are correctly divesting of fossil fuel investments, you're glorifying an extractive technology that's contributing to climate change and harming Pennsylvanians and our environment in the process. And they wanted your book removed as the book that all the freshmen are reading this year. I mean, how do you respond to complaints like that?
Well, a couple things. So first of all, the idea that this book glorifies fracking, I take a lot of exception to. I don't think I'm glorifying fracking. I think what I'm doing is writing about, as a nonfiction writer, about a technology that's really important, and we all need to contend with it and understand about it. I don't think I glorify it. I certainly didn't mean to glorify it. But, you know, on the other, one of the other things that they talk about, or some of the protesters said, was that, well, look, you know, there's been all this research that's been done in the last year since the book came out that really advances our knowledge of this. And, you know, there is a point there. You can't write a book and then keep rewriting it every year to update it. And there has been a lot of work done since the book's come out, which is raising questions about the health impact. You know, what is the impact of living within a mile, and about this issue of methane leakage, how much methane is leaking. But the book really sets the framework to try to understand fracking. And what I write about in the book, and what the history of this really showed me, was that when the shale boom really begins, the rush to develop the land, the industry and the companies moved really quickly. And they sort of drilled first and then asked questions later. And so we're at a point right now where we are asking those questions. And many of those questions are very valid. What's the health impact? Is the process of disposing of waste from these wells causing earthquakes? What about methane leakage? Is that contributing to climate change? You know, is natural gas still as good a fuel, as you argue, versus coal because of methane leakage? These are all really good, valid questions. And, you know, I come back to a quote by the Energy Secretary, Ernest Moniz, who he actually said before he became the Energy Secretary when he was still a professor at MIT. And he said, look, there are problems associated with fracking. All of these problems are manageable. And he sort of pauses and says, that doesn't mean they're all being managed, but they're manageable. And I think that's a really smart way of thinking about this. This is an industrial process that grew up and came very quickly and changed very quickly. We haven't had time to work out all the kinks yet. There are problems associated with fracking, but they're manageable. And there are a lot of benefits associated with fracking too. So, you know, really the challenge right now for all of us, myself, you, listeners, everyone, is to try to figure out how to manage that. Because right now, we are drilling 50 to 100 wells a day and fracking them. Even with this downturn, we're still drilling a large number of wells. And, you know, it just seems to me that it's all of our responsibility to figure out what are the problems, how do you manage them, and let's try to do this right. Because people who live in rural Pennsylvania and rural Texas and urban Fort Worth, Texas, you know, they deserve to be able to live their life without having undue environmental damage. We all do.
Russell Gold, thank you for talking with us.
Oh, Emily, it's been my pleasure. Thank you very much.
WPSU's Emily Reddy talked with reporter Russell Gold about his new book titled The Boom, which is about hydraulic fracturing or fracking. Thanks for listening to Take Note. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.